Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to be talking, as I have been doing recently, about Operation Barbarossa, the biggest land invasion in human history, the invasion of the Soviet Union by Nazi Germany. And I want to talk about Stalin's response. So obviously this was an immense shock to Stalin, and Stalin seems to have suffered some kind of nervous breakdown. Now, the interesting part about the story isn't the shock that Stalin undergoes, the moment where reality crashes through denial, but what Stalin does afterwards. Stalin had delegated to Vyacheslav Molotov, his foreign minister, much of the day-to-day running of things temporarily, and had given him the role of explaining to the Soviet people that the war with Nazi Germany had begun. There was a broadcast made at 12:15 on the 22nd of June, and as the days dragged on, Stalin met with commanders. And there were 29 lengthy meetings about the invasion, which Stalin berated and criticised and tried to deflect. There were some decisions made which were extremely important. The most significant of these in those immediate discussions was the removal of an industrial plant east of the Urals, out of bombing range. And this, in many ways, is the key to Soviet survival, the recreation of tank factories and aircraft factories east of the Urals created eventually an almost inexhaustible supply of munitions to be shipped westwards out of the, again, the range of German aircraft. The other thing that was thoroughly done by the Soviet state on the in the days after the invasion, again on Stalin's orders, were the removal of political prisoners, those already in custody, those who the NKVD had their eye on, to camps in the interior, and the execution of large numbers of prisoners who were deemed either too dangerous to deport or too much of a hindrance to deport. So why go to the time and trouble of mass executions when you're facing the German army? To understand that one, you have to really drill down into Stalinist thinking. Stalin had been obsessed throughout the 1930s that there were fifth columns and internal troublemakers, perhaps those who had never really accepted the revolution, those of enemy classes and enemy parts of the party, reactionary aspects to the party. that given half the chance, if there was a foreign invasion, would rise up against the Soviet Union. Here was a country that had been born of revolution and civil war, and here was an ideology that was steeped in the anxieties not just of the Russian Revolution, but of European revolutions dating all the way back to the French Revolution. As I've said before many a time, Stalin and Lenin were constantly mindful of the problems faced by Robespierre and the Jacobin in the French Revolution and the in civil wars and uprisings in places like the Vendée during the French Revolution. So the idea that there were all these troublemaking people and dangerous types who were really, you know, exhausted, emaciated men and women stuck in prison cells. That's what they were. They were of no threat whatsoever. But in the Soviet imagination, the Stalinist imagination, these guys meet up with the Nazis. If the Nazis manage to make it as far as Moscow, and you've got potentially a puppet government waiting to depose Stalin and overthrow the revolution. The reality was that Hitler's plans for Russia were going to be far more barbaric even than that. Lots of those who were deported were men and women with German names, and they were going to be persecuted even further as the war dragged on. Privately owned radios were removed from houses. There was to be, in Stalin's eyes, no further consumption of news information in a private space. News would be delivered collectively in the workplace and in other public places, and this would be done in an ordered way at strictly determined times. This meant that when the news from the front came in, and it was heard by Soviet citizens, Soviet citizens would dare not be critical or make their own minds up about what the news meant. They would, in a collective atmosphere, respond the way the state wanted them to. Stalin was desperate to believe that for a couple of days that the invasion had been a dreadful misunderstanding. This shows the extent to which Stalin was prepared and able to delude himself and kid himself. He had become so enamoured with the idea of an understanding with Hitler that might possibly, in Stalin's further imagination, have blossomed into a full alliance later on, that he had blinded himself to the realities of what Hitler had in mind. There was the kind of the threads, the thinnest threads of evidence from Soviet agents in European countries, that there might be some kind of dialogue that can be had with the Germans, where some kind of negotiated settlement could be had. But these were all rejected by the Germans. The fateful day comes on the 28th of June. On that day, Minsk falls in Belorussia, and Stalin finally has his kind of breakdown. He goes to his dacha in outside Moscow, and a delegation, after hearing nothing from him for a day or two, a delegation visits on the 30th. Headed by Anastas Mikoyan, and Stalin believes that he is there to be arrested and probably executed. Stalin says to them, you know, "Comrades, why have you come?" Believing that he was wanting them to kind of out themselves as conspirators against him. And the dictator Stalin can't quite believe his luck when they arrive and they say, "Well, we need you to lead us. We believe that there should be essentially a military dictator for the war, a marshal." And he says, "Well, who do you have in mind?" And they say, "You, comrade Stalin." And Stalin pulls himself together and leads with a broadcast on the 3rd of July to the Russian people. In this broadcast, he starts to drop the rhetoric of class and really embrace the rhetoric of nation. Comrades, brothers and sisters, fighters of our army and fleet, I address you, my friends. He demanded of Soviet citizens a great patriotic war. And the first act in that great patriotic war had to be as Tsar Alexander I had done in 1812, and the destruction of everything that the enemy could find useful. That's the scorched earth policy. And he spoke long before, or days before at least, there was any suggestion of an alliance with Britain. Stalin spoke directly as the British as potential allies, and said that the Soviet Union and the British and other still fighting nations should be part of a coalition, a united front of peoples standing for freedom. Obviously, the idea of freedom as in Stalin's eyes is really quite a kind of an obtuse one. And then from that moment on, Stalin seems to have regained his nerve. And it's this bit I find most interesting, that Stalin has this dramatic turnaround. And one of Stalin's skills, really, is being able to finally pull it out of the bag when he realises there are no alternatives. It is either he becomes the war leader that he finally does become, or he faces overthrow and the firing squad, or he faces German tanks in Moscow. At the end of the Second World War, Stalin, of all the war leaders, was arguably, in terms of his own goals and agenda, the most successful. Churchill failed to secure the freedom of Poland. He failed in the long term to secure the future of the empire. Roosevelt dies in 1945, and his successor Truman is unable to overturn a Soviet hegemony in Eastern Europe. So Stalin, from this kind of weak and enfeebled position in June 1941, actually manages a kind of an epic turnaround of fortunes, however drenching his own people in as much blood as Hitler did. Stalin became chairman of the Stavka, which was the staff HQ, chairman of the State Committee for Defence, the People's Commissariat for Defence and the Transport Commission, and eventually on the 8th of August he promotes himself to being Supreme Commander of the Red Army. Roosevelt's title in peacetime and wartime, as all US presidents have been, is Commander-in-Chief of the US Armed Forces. And Churchill was not just Prime Minister, but also self-appointed Minister for Defence. And both Parliament and Congress, respectively, voted Churchill and Roosevelt sort of extraordinary powers to prosecute the course of the war. So all three leaders of the Grand Alliance became essentially de facto warlords, though obviously Stalin was far more capable of retaining whatever powers he thought necessary thereafter. However, Stalin's fortunes wouldn't really change until late 1942, early 1943, when he took the wise decision to hand over operations to his generals Zhukov, Konev, and others.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends.
For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Realizing that he knew very little about the art of war, far less than, for example, his hated rival Trotsky had learned during the Russian Civil War. Stalin was opposed to retreats. His demands that the Red Army stand and fight saw countless Red Armies, countless Army divisions encircled by the Wehrmacht, who were masters of tank warfare, of highly mobile warfare, and encirclement and destruction was the key to their operations. The idea that ground should be held to the last simply meant that inexperienced soldiers who were poorly equipped and poorly led were annihilated, and these were useful men who could be thrown into battle at a later time. Men were frequently arrested and shot for desertion, for retreating, and it was only midway through the Second World War that Stalin realises that these approaches are not helping. On August 16th, 1941, Stalin gave the order 270, which called for the execution of malicious deserters, as he put it, and the arrest of their families. It quoted, "Those falling into encirclements are to fight to the last. Those who prefer to surrender are to be destroyed by all available means." And this was read out by army commissars at assemblies of soldiers. So the men knew what awaited their families. If they deserted, but even if they were captured, Soviet prisoners who somehow managed to survive treatment by the Germans and who were returned at the end of the war faced at least an 8-year spell in the gulags for the crime of desertion. Some 168,000 civilians during the war were sentenced to death and executed for cowardice and desertion. Now, these accusations cover up a vast range of different behaviours, whether these were people who were kidnapped and forced to work in the Third Reich, or they were people who fled in the face of the Nazi war machine, or they were people who were simply dislocated by war and found themselves in different parts of the country without much of an explanation. They faced the most draconian of punishments. Stalin liked to keep civilians where they were. This was a great incentive for their husbands and fathers and brothers to fight for them, and it was also a way of inducing the civilian population to fight alongside them. Some 300,000 Russian soldiers were executed by their own army, which was a larger figure than the number of British soldiers who were killed by enemy action during the entirety of the Second World War. The fate of Soviet citizens who managed to escape from the Wehrmacht and get back to their own lines was equally bleak. Soviet citizens or soldiers who were then captured by the NKVD as a result of having been in Nazi captivity were put into suicide units, shock troops to be flung at the enemy lines by way of punishment. 47,000 deserters were detained in Moscow as the German army approached, and there were large numbers of executions for a terror descended upon the city once more, as citizens and soldiers were executed for fascist agitation. Much of this was completely imagined, and there was a kind of a strange air of crisis in the city, where not only was this terror taking place, but as the German army approaches, the belief that the Soviet regime has days to go and is about to be overthrown, or often has people actually retaliating against NKVD officers in the absence of state authority, as the state seems to be kind of close to collapsing. Political officers were given the same powers as operational commanders, and this is a significant problem in decision-making. Soldiers understand about military and strategic decision-making, and ideally don't want a political commissaire there making political decisions, which often run contrary to the needs of good military order or battlefield common sense. And Stalin, like Hitler, was attempting to micromanage his armies. Now, there's an interesting comparison here. So I may have mentioned before that with the Wehrmacht and the Kaiser Army during World War One, the principle of Auftragstaktik was what kind of informed German military success. Auftragstaktik says basically sort of staff officers, field marshals, senior generals create the overall strategic picture, i.e. seize Paris. And it's down to divisional commanders on the ground, brigadiers and colonels and those sorts of figures, to decide how their armies move and how they achieve the overall objective. But because they are there in the field, they get to figure it out. Hitler began to gradually erode Auftragstaktik until the general staff even have basically no room to manoeuvre, and they are simply having to carry out Hitler's increasingly perverse orders whilst he is removed from the battlefield, and divisional commanders are largely paralysed. Some report even having received phone calls from Hitler whilst in the field. Stalin, working the same process of micromanagement as we've just seen, he was the person that returns a kind of Auftragstaktik to the army by suddenly seeing the benefits of allowing not only the general staff but divisional commanders to get on with jobs and do what they're meant to do. Now, the only reason that he was comfortable doing this was because he knew that there was a sufficient amount of terror that could be inflicted that would keep generals and officers in line. Not that he particularly needed to, because following June 1941, the Soviet army, the Red Army, becomes largely motivated to repulse the enemy from Soviet soil. Soviet morale itself was obviously extremely low. Stalin had called for a partisan war, knowing his armies on the Western Front against the Wehrmacht had been destroyed. He called for partisan warfare to take on the enemy. But most Soviet citizens saw through this and saw it for the kind of the empty gesture that it was. Later in the war, obviously, it becomes a significant tool of war against Germany, but not, it would appear, in the first days of the war in 1941. The hope that Stalin placed in Great Britain and then later in the USA is often not shared by Soviet citizens, and it's hardly surprising that they've been indoctrinated against the capitalist powers for a long period of time. And it was in living memory that it was British and American soldiers invading the Soviet nation and not Germany. The great war correspondent Vasily Grossman, and I did do a thing on him a while back, spoke of an encounter with a group of peasants behind the front line. And he wrote, "They are crying. Whether they are riding somewhere or standing by the fences, they begin to cry as soon as they begin to speak. And one feels an involuntary desire to cry too. There's so much grief. An old woman thought she might see her son in the column that was trudging through the dust. She stood there until the evening and then came to us. Soldiers, take some cucumbers. Eat, you're welcome. Soldiers, drink this milk. Soldiers, apples. Soldiers, curds. Soldiers, please take this." And they cry, these women. They cry, looking at the men marching past them. Many of the young men in these columns were, of course, conscripts and had little enthusiasm for battle. They were poorly educated. Many of them were illiterate. The best soldiers that could be found were drafted into the NKVD, which grew to 600,000 strong eventually. But those who were from the Ukraine, the Baltic states and Belarusia were seen as being too unreliable and too potentially likely to embrace Nazism and work with the invader. Not that that was in any way true at all, that to be included in the NKVD. The real reason why they weren't included is obviously because on the Baltic states and in the Ukraine and in Belarusia, Stalinist terror had been in occasions at its most acute. So in an army where the officer corps had been purged, and for the first few months the bewildered recruits were simply taught only how to march, who often had no boots and very often had no rifles, who understood simply about taking cover, but only when given the command to do so. So you had men standing still when being strafed by aircraft simply because they were too frightened to do otherwise. They understood about very simple combat drill with wooden rifles, you know, obviously wooden replica rifles, and understood the basic rudiments of trench digging, but basically nothing else. These were men who were on foot. There was no transport for them and virtually no barracks. The most important thing those soldiers had, and they learned to cherish it, was a bowl and a spoon. And they had only the experience of retreat up until midway through the war. And so it was very difficult to have any kind of morale from these soldiers, and that simply the predations of the enemy and the horrific actions of the German army in Russia eventually helped to build that morale. Anyway, I hope you found this useful. A little new feature we've got. I've created a Explaining History Facebook group, so the link to that should be in this the blurb under this podcast. If you want to talk about this podcast, discuss it, or get any feedback or advice on essays or anything like that, follow the link, join the group, and let the conversation begin. Anyway, look forward to catching you all soon, and see you in the group, and have a nice week. Bye bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.